this topic, and it's partly due to Brother Harry. Back years and years ago, he was the first person I ever knew and the only person that I know that's been a Weaves revival going through the Bible, telling the stories when they happened in chronological order. And that meant a lot to me back then because I'd heard bits and pieces and stories and this and that and all the time, but I never did put them all together. So I just mentioned to Brad, what if we take the knights and divide them up and just go over the Old Testament? So we decided to try that. He had three knights and I had three knights. And I don't know that I have ever spent as much time studying for three lessons in my whole life as I have. And I know he spent a lot of time on it too, trying to get it right. A lot of times I'll approach a revival and I'll just think, if only one person listens to me and can feel what I feel, if I can just get that across to one person, then my efforts will be a success. Well, I want to tell you that this revival is already a success, if that's all it takes, because I've been revived. I just hope that I can get the feelings to you. This story is awesome. This is not going to be a collection of stories from the Old Testament. This is a story of the Old Testament. And you'll see how fast we're going to go tonight, what we're trying to do. A little bit of background. Last night, we have our map behind us. It starts out straight up with time zero with Adam, and it swings around straight down to the star being Christ, being a period of, say, 4,000 years. And then we swing up to the right to present-day time at 2,000. Now, if you remember last night, Brad went from zero, which his topic was the conception of God's people, and we'll talk about the difference between conception and birth in just a minute. But he talked about from Adam down to, say, about right here. Well, you see, I'm going to talk about this little bitty bit right here. So that means that he spent 45 minutes last night, and I should be through in about 7 minutes. But I'm going to drag it out because y'all drove too far for me just to stand up here for 7 minutes. But we'll try not to go much past 8 o'clock. All right. The conception of God's people and the birth of God's people. Why would we call tonight the birth of God's people, the nation of Israel? Why did there even need to be a nation? Well, Brad hinted at it last night. God wanted to affect the world. He wasn't going to affect the world with one family. If that would have worked, he would have stopped with Job. But he knew that to affect another nation, he had to have a nation. He knew if Jesus Christ was going to come, there needed to be a nation with a history for Jesus to come to, a history that would have affected the world so that it could continue to affect the world. So God needed a nation, not a family, even of 70 people. But he needed a nation. Now, where are you going to get a nation? Now, just think of it. Now, we're going to read in just a little bit that God could have created one from rocks. But that would have defeated the purpose. He wanted people to choose to serve him. He didn't want to make the people and then make them serve him. So where would he get a nation of people in a world that was already inhabited? He would grow it. Now, those of you that are familiar with physiology and biology and all that stuff, you know that the period of time that a woman carries a baby is called a period of gestation. Okay, I propose to you that the children of Israel were in Egypt gestating for 430 years because during that time they were growing in number. They were growing in number. Now think. Now this is a broad topic now. Open your eyes, open your minds up. What three things do you need to have a nation? Well, you've got to have people. I mean, you've got to have a population. You've got to have folks. Okay? Second thing you've got to have some land. They got to have somewhere to call home, national boundaries. Third thing you've got to have is you've got to have a unity of purpose. There's got to be something to hold these people together. Okay? So God starts out with growing people. He's growing folks in Egypt. He's growing folks in Egypt. Now think of this. where in the on the face of the earth could he more likely grow a people from 70 to about 3 million in 400 years? What do they got to have? They got to have some kind of protection, because in those days, nations attack nations. And he can't grow from 70 people to 3 million if every 10 years there's a war and half the males are wiped out. So there's got to be some protection. He's got to be able to feed them. Where are you going to feed 3 million people unless you're going to give them bread and quail all the time? And that's not what he wanted to do, because he wanted them to be self-sufficient and independent, and so they could be an example for all the other nations. So where would you put them? In the mountains? Not enough food. In the desert? Not enough water. But what is Egypt? What river runs through Egypt? The Nile. And what do we know happens at the mouth of the great rivers of the world? They make a huge delta. The most fertile land in the world is in the deltas of the rivers. And so we have the perfect combination. We got Egypt, which through Joseph, through the way Joseph went there, Joseph didn't go in as an outlaw. He rose to second in command. So Joseph started out getting what he wanted out of Pharaoh. So instead of the people coming in as captives, they came in as the relatives of the second in command. So Pharaoh said, "Where do you want to go?" And they said, "We want to go to Goshen, the land of Goshen, the most fertile land in the world. That's where we want to live." So Egypt protected them. They were protected. They had agriculture. They had food. Egypt let them alone so that they could continue a national culture, a family culture. They grew up being able to teach each other about God, even though they didn't follow him all the time. They could create the unity and maintain the unity of spirit. So they're in gestation in Egypt. So where does the birth come from? Crossing the Red Sea. And we'll show you that in just a minute. But for right now, hang on. We got to fly. The birth of God's people. We're going to talk about 470 years of time. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua. I'll give you one more disclaimer. If I give you any dates and you disagree with them, that's fine. Because when I first started this study, my background is in engineering. Okay, so I'm thinking numbers. So the first thing I wanted to do when I started this study is I want to make me a timeline. And I'm going to nail down a date, and I'm going to nail down something that happened on that date, and that's my hook for my memorization, to learn it. And I found out I couldn't do that. Depends on who you're reading after. It depends on what book you're reading after. It's to what century something happened in. So I'm going to give you things general and use the Bible, use the internal evidence of the Bible wherever I can to show you. And as far as time goes, I don't know that it matters whether something happened in the 15th century or the 16th century B.C. What is important is you believe it happened. So that's the standpoint. If I throw you a date, it's just to keep things relative. So we're going to talk about 470 years, and I'll show you where this comes from. So here's a story. Here's a story. The children of Israel, family of Jacob, had been in Egypt about 350 years when Moses was born. They went in there as traveling folks trying to avoid a famine. They settled down. They gradually became, you might say, slaves. They became bondsmen. And you say, how can this happen? It can happen easy. It can happen real easy. How many of us are bondsmen to the bank? Or the financial company, or whoever's holding our mortgage, whoever's holding our car loan, whoever's providing our salary, that we've got to work at a certain place. It's easy to become a bondsman. So they were there about 350 years, gestating, growing, multiplying. Moses came along, and he was raised in Pharaoh's palace. You know the story of the ark, patched with mud and stuff, and floated out, and Pharaoh's daughter found this child, was raised in the palace, so he knew of all the things that was going on in the palace. raised an educated person in Egypt. About 40 years old, according to the New Testament, he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God. He found an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, killed the Egyptian. The next day he went out to try to stop two Hebrews from fighting, and one of them said, "Who made you a judge? You're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" And so Moses knew his deed was found out, and he had to flee. Pharaoh was going to kill him. So he fled. He fled to Midian. Midian is a place southeast of where they were in Egypt. He fled to Midian, and there he met his wife and future father-in-law and got a family. And it's also where he saw the burning bush. See, I'm telling you, not all the details, but some of the big ones, so you can kind of keep in your mind where these things fit in the story. Where they fit in the story. About 80 years old, he's about 80 years old. He was back before Pharaoh, demanding for the people to be free, narrating the plagues. He would tell Pharaoh what was fixing to happen. I don't know whether Pharaoh didn't believe him, or he thought he was so tough he could stand it. But no, Moses would come in and tell him what was going to happen. He said, "All you got to do is let my people go, and all this won't happen to you." The plagues struck directly at the gods of Egypt. You got to understand, Egypt worshipped everything. They worshipped the river, they worshipped the crocodile, they worshipped, and but they're not alone. A lot of nations, most nations, that did not worship our God, worshipped all kinds of gods, all kinds of things. If you look at the plagues, the blood, the frogs, the lice, the flies, the murrain, the death of the animals, the boils, the hail, the locusts, the darkness, and finally the death of the firstborn. It struck at the gods of Egypt. Now this is important because Israel needed to see this. Israel has been living here among these Egyptians, watching them worship all these gods. Now can you imagine worshiping the god of the flies? Now think of it. What better thing could God do than to look down upon his people and say, "You like flies? You want to worship the god of the flies? I'll give you flies. They'll be in your ears. They'll be in your eyes. They'll be in your nose. They'll be in your mouth. You can't sit down without sitting on your god. I'll give you flies." And all these other things. He just ate them up. God just ate them up with it. Israel saw all these things. And what God wanted Israel to do was to see how foolish it is to worship any of these things. How foolish. And to worship the true God. See, all this time, see, what's God doing? He's building national spirit. He's building unity. He's growing folks. They're gestating. They're having babies right and left. They're seeing what's happening. They're growing to know there is one God. Only one God. The people were released and escaped capture through the Red Sea. Now remember this one, because toward the end of the lesson, we're going to come back with what Paul said about this one event. And I hope that I can show you just how special this one thing is. We think about them people crossing the Red Sea, and it's a wondrous thing if you saw the movie. Wondrous thing. But what it meant, what it meant is incredible. What it meant when you were baptized, when you were reborn, when you were raised to walk in newness of life. What it mean? This was the baptism of the people of God. This is the birth. This is the coming out. This is the time when the gestation time is over with, and it's time to live and be a nation. That's what coming out of Egypt was. God proves the people with manna and quail. Two simple things. Food. He proved them with food. Will you trust me? I'm telling you, I'm going to give you the manna that you need from one day to the next. Don't gather more than what you need this one day. I'll be here for you tomorrow. Now, what would you do? What do you do now? Do you trust him now? Do you trust him to take care of you tomorrow? A lot of so-called Christians don't even trust him to take care of them today, much less take care of you tomorrow. But this is what God used to prove the people. Will they obey me in how much bread they gather each day? The Ten Commandments were given twice. You know that story. And the law of the covenant was given, so the people now have a written law. We assume they were living under an oral law, but now they have a written law. The pattern of the tabernacle was given, that tent-like structure where people worshiped, where there was an inner sanctuary that if you entered at the wrong time, it would mean death. That's pretty powerful for it just to be a tent. But that's what God gave to the people. After about 2 years of wandering in the wilderness, the spies were sent out, a man from each of the 12 tribes, to look out the land to see if it was ready for the people to enter and take their promised land in Canaan. The people came and listened to the spies' report. 10 of the spies said, "People are too great for us. We can't take them." 2 of them said, "We can take them." The people listened to the 10. They retreated. And so God gave them 38 years to wander about and die. Now, I don't know how well this is going to show up, but you can see the blue is the water. This is the Mediterranean Sea, and this is the area of the Promised Land around the southeast side of the Mediterranean Sea. This is the land of Egypt. There's the Nile River. There's the big river delta. The land of Goshen was about in this area. The children of Israel wandered around in this area and got away from, escaped Pharaoh, went down to the southern end of the peninsula here to Mount Sinai, where they camped and received the Ten Commandments. They traveled up to about the place called Kadesh and sent the spies up into the Promised Land. Okay? They're ready to go in the front door of the Promised Land. See, right here's what they're trying to get to, around Jerusalem and Canaan. That is the Promised Land. They are right here. Short trip. We just go right through there, just burst the doors wide open, and we've got our land. Everything was ready, but them. They were not ready. They still had bondsman mentality. They've been bondsmen so long, they are not prepared to be warriors, to be soldiers, and to be fighters. They're just like an infant. Listen, this story is so much like the way a child is born and has to be protected. And a child is in the mother's womb during the gestation, and then it's born, but then it's so vulnerable it has to be protected. That's the way this nation is. There's so many parallels to you and I, physically and spiritually. Okay, so here they are, and since I have the map up here, I'll go ahead and show you this, since the map's here. They were told to wander around until the 40 years was up, until that generation died. Okay? Then when God took them into the Promised Land, he still didn't take them straight in. They went around this way, which is what that arrow represents. They went around to the east and came across somewhere along in here about where Jericho would be. So they kind of looped around, and I don't know if you say they went around and came in the back door or the front door, but they didn't go in the easiest way. They had to go around to get there. Now, there's a lesson in that. A lot of things they went through was meant to temper them and make them stronger. Wasn't meant to be easy. It was to temper them. Moses failed at the water of Meribah, which is somewhere about that area of Kadesh. He was commanded to strike a rock, and he spoke to a rock and said, "Must we fetch you water, you rebels?" And God chastised him and told him that he had not glorified God. He had taken some of it on himself, the way he handled that issue. And so for that one thing, Moses was not allowed to go into the Promised Land, but he could get on a mountain and look over the Jordan River into the Promised Land and see what it was. Joshua, one of the 2 spies that agreed they could take the Promised Land, was the one that was allowed to lead the people across the Jordan River, around Jericho, into the Promised Land, taking over the nations that were there, with a few exceptions, but most of those nations, and acquired the land that they divided among the 12 tribes on the west and the east side of the Jordan River. So that's the story of the birth of God's people. They came from, at the beginning of the story, they came from humble beginnings in Egypt. They went through a time of gestation to where they grew to a large number of people, enough to be considered a nation. And then the Lord led them, tempering them all the way, testing them, proving them, making them struggle. All the way through the promised land until they, all the way through the desert wilderness until they got to the promised land. And so there we have Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Numbers, and Joshua. But we're not through yet. I've still got a few more minutes. So what we're going to do now is to look back at some really important points. That's a great story. That's a fantastic story. But I want to give you something to take home with you. We're going to talk about five things. Just things of interest. Something you might have thought about before. We're going to talk about the population. We're going to talk about Egypt as Israel's birthplace. How Egypt reflects different faces of bondage. How God had a point in doing it this way. And then, what was it? Why? Do you ever think about some of the things you read in the scriptures and just wonder, Lord, why did you do it this way? There's a lot of questions about this story. Why did it have to be done this way? So let's first talk about the population. Some say they didn't stay 430 years in the wilderness. Some say they only stayed 225 or some other period. But how do you go from 70 to 3 million, and why do we even think 3 million in the first place? Well, if we look at Numbers, the first chapter, verse 46, when they first got across the Red Sea and began wandering in the wilderness, the people were numbered, and they, from 20 years old and upward, those that were able to go to war, there were 603,550 men. That's soldiers. Okay. You assume wives, parents still alive, children, servants, maidservants, or anybody else that was with them, that's how we think that it may have been 3 million total. If you've got about 600,000 fighting men, there's got to be a supporting cast behind all of that. So let's say 3 million. So how can you go to 3 million from the ones that we just started? Well, we're going to ask another question first before I get ahead of myself. What happened to them when they were in the wilderness? The Numbers, the 26th chapter, verse 2 and verse 51, said they numbered the people again after wandering in the wilderness 40 years. And they had 601,730, about the same. The population didn't increase much in that 40 years, but at least it stayed about constant. Now this is just food for thought right here. Why did this 602,000 people have the guts to go into the promised land when this 604,000 didn't? Why? What was different? The first 604,000, they spent their lives as bondsmen. They were being told what to do. They lived next to the flesh pots in Egypt. They lived in the land of Goshen, which, as we mentioned, was some of the most fertile land on the face of the earth. Plenty of food. Could grow anything in that land. This group right here, 602,000 men, where'd they grow up? They grew up struggling. They grew up in the wilderness. They grew up eating bread and quail. They grew up with God leading them. Cloud by day and pillar fire by night. Whole different background. I don't know if that's what it was or not. You come up with a reason. But whatever reason it was, in 40 years, you change from 604,000 men to 602,000 men. The first ones are afraid to go in. The next group is ready to go. So something happened. Something happened. And I propose to you that whatever happened to them is going to have to happen to you and I if we're going to get to heaven. You and I have got to have the intestinal fortitude to make the right decision. If you and I have the attitude of these 604,000, we're not going to make it because we're going to be too afraid to practice self-discipline. on ourselves, much less help somebody else. Okay, so what about the growth? Is it possible? Well, now, I'm not really a statistician, but I can add and subtract. Let's start out with 55 couples. Now, where did 55 couples come from? The Bible said there were 70 that came into Egypt to start with. Well, if you read the account in Genesis about the 46th chapter, it gives the name of those people. And the 70 are arrived by counting Jacob and the heads of the 12 tribes. But those men had already had their family. If you count the descendants, which were still having families and kids, there's about 55 men. The men were counted. For what reason, I don't know. But the men were counted. So we got 55 men. So now let's make some assumptions now. Let's say we got 55 couples to start with. If you count the number of children that those 12 sons had, it averaged 4.5. If you make another assumption, it's bad to do, but if you make another assumption that they had an equal number of sons as daughters, they had 4.5 sons, they had 4.5 daughters. So they got 9 children altogether. So if you say that that's about average for every couple, then the Lord's blessing these people. The Lord blessed them so that they could be fruitful and multiply. They averaged 9 children. How long would it take a wife, a mother, to have 9 children? And then for them to start having children. So let's say 33 years. Let's really say that everything's working right. And every 33 years, there's another generation. So we're going to turn a generation every 33 years. We're going to let folks live to be about 100. So every time we click off 100 years, we got the count that we're going to kill off so many. So we're going to try to keep the numbers right. We're going to add and we're going to deduct some. 7 generations will produce 5.2 million people. That means everybody, every couple, has 9 kids. And they all get married, equal number of boys and girls, and they all have 9 kids, and they all so on and so forth. You see the picture. Okay, 33 years, 7 generations. Okay, that's about less than 250 years, between 225 and 250 years. So for those that say they weren't in Egypt 430 years, they were in there 225, mathematically it's conceivable. Hey, the Lord might have blessed them, they might have had 40 kids, I don't know. But let's make another assumption. Let's look at it another way. 55 couples, this time let's say they only average 6 children. 6 children, and they can have 6 children quicker than they can have 9. So for the sake of argument, let's say, in using round numbers, let's say they're going to turn a generation in 25 years, average lifespan of 100 years, 9 generations will generate 3.2 million people. It's still doable. Can't argue with you about how long it took. Don't know how long it took. I know what the Bible says. That's what I'm going to go by. But the thing I want you to notice is, either way, 7 or 9 or perhaps more, it was still many generations that these people were in bondage. How many generations can you remember? We take the oldest person here, and if all of his descendants were here, we might come up with 3 or 4 generations. Okay, how many can you remember back? Anybody here can remember 7 generations? Can remember what grandpa's life was like? If your family was in slavery for 6 generations, but great-great-great-great-grandpa 7 generations back was a free man, how much of that can you remember? Nothing. All you know is slavery. All you know is being a bondsman. So to me, this is the important thing out of this. However many years it was that God let them gestate, they were there long enough that all they knew was being a bondsman. That's all they knew. They didn't know anything about being a soldier, being a diplomat, being a politician, being a statesman, being a whatever it takes to be a nation. They didn't know it. They weren't raised with it. So God had his work cut out for them. And that's what all this is about. Okay, Egypt is Israel's birthplace. We're fixing to take off flying again because what I want to show you, and I didn't realize this, is how many times the coming out of Egypt is mentioned in the Bible. Let's look at the first one. It was foretold to Abraham, Genesis 15 and 13. He said to Abram, know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years before it even happened. Egypt's bondage began real innocently, Genesis 46, verses 3 and 4. He said, I am God, speaking to Jacob. I am God, the God of your father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of you a great nation. I will go down with you into Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. Jacob had no fear about going there. He didn't know what was going to happen, but God said, don't worry, I'll be with you. The bondage began in a small way, Genesis 46, verses 7 through 27. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came to Egypt, were 70, and that's going to be males. You got your wives, children, servants, whatever, added to that. But that's, you go to there, you count the names, those are going to be the males. You might throw Dinah in there, she was a sister. But it began with a small number. Egypt's bondage began in a subtle way. Exodus 1, verses 6 and 7. Joseph died and all his brethren and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. And the Egyptians said, whoa, these Hebrews, they are more and mightier than we are. We've got to get them under control. So they put bonds, they put taskmasters over them to make them work. And the Egyptians said, okay, if this is where I'm going to be, and this is where I can get food, I'll work for you. Little did they realize that that bondage would slowly become slavery. Okay, parallel to you and I, little do we realize when we stick our toe in sin that what feels so good and so innocent to start with will consume every speck of our being if we let it. We will slowly be consumed by sin, just like Israel's freedom was slowly consumed by bondage. And that bondage caused the cry for help. Exodus 2 and 23, it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. And the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Egypt's bondage ended with a large number. It began with 70 men. Numbers 1, 45 and 46. From 20 years old and upward, all that were able to go forth to war in Israel, even all that were numbered, were 600,000 and 3,550 men that came across the Red Sea. As soon as it happened, it was restated. It was restated in Exodus, Exodus 12, verses 40 and 41. Now, the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now, the wanderings of 40 years, so 40 years plus 430 is where I got the 470 that we're going to talk about, that we are talking about now. So I'm trying to use the internal numbers wherever I can. Okay, we look a little farther down the history line. David, some 300, 400 years later, still talking about Egypt. 2 Samuel 7 and 23, and what one nation in the earth is like your people, even like Israel, whom God went to redeem for his people to himself, and to make him a name, and to do for you great things and terrible for your land before your people, which you redeemed to you from Egypt, from the nations and their gods. The time of Solomon, even later, was talking about Egypt. 1 Kings 6 and 1, it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, that he, Solomon, began to build the house of the Lord. See, 480 years, and they're still referring to that as a landmark event. When Solomon dedicated the temple and made his speech, he went back to that time. 1 Kings 8 and 16, since the day that I brought forth my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city out of all the tribes of Israel to build a house, that my name might be therein. But I chose David to be over my people Israel. But one more time, He takes the people back to Egypt as a landmark in time. The Lord spoke of it through Amos. A few hundred years later, the prophet Amos 2 and 10 said, "Also I brought you up from the land of Egypt and led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorites." Maybe 100 years later, the Lord spoke of it again through Micah. Micah 6 and 4, "For I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of servants, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam." Okay. Stephen's death speech, New Testament. New Testament, the speech Stephen gave before he got stoned. Acts 7:34, I have seen the affliction of my people, which is in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning, and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you into Egypt. Paul referred to Acts 13:17 and 18, "The God of this people of Israel chose our fathers and exalted the people, but they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with a high arm brought he them out of it, and about the time of 40 years suffered he their manners in the wilderness." See how important that was? I did not realize how many times the coming out of Egypt was mentioned. To me, the crossing of the Red Sea was just another story like Daniel in the lion's den. But it's not. That's like the birth, and that's why the title of the lesson is The Birth of the Nation, the Nation of Israel. Now let's look real quickly about how just the word Egypt refers to different faces of bondage. We know that it refers to physical bondage, of course. That's obvious. Deuteronomy 6 and 21, "Then you shall say unto your son, we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand." Physical bondage. It was also a time of the spiritual law of bondage. Galatians 4, 24 and 26, "Which things are an allegory. For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which genders to bondage." See, we're still referring to that time of Egypt and immediately crossing the Red Sea, Mount Sinai, the giving of the law, the bondage of all that time, "which is Agar. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and answers to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all." The Jews saw a reference to this bondage in Jesus' speech, John 8:32 and 34. "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. I say you, you shall be made free." Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever commits sin is the servant of sin." Jesus is speaking of freedom from sin. The Jews see it as Abraham's seed, the time of bondage. It's all pointing back to that time in the history when they were in Egyptian bondage. Okay. It is a place of sin from which to escape. You and I come out of Egypt, so to speak, when we are baptized and we are reborn. 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 6. Now soak this one in now. "Our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat and drink the same spiritual drink, and they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." How important was coming out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea? It was their baptism. "Baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea." What happens to us? We get baptized into Christ. Baptized underwater for the remission of sins, be raised to walk in newness of life. So many parallels of what happened to them physically happens to us spiritually. Such a beautiful story. And notice down here, "We should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." sin. We can be made slaves to sin. There's just no end to the comparison. But the beauty is, God is going to get us out. So now we're going to ask the thinking questions. What was God doing? Why did he do it this way? Well, he had a point, and we need to understand this point. God planned to send a message. Deuteronomy 2 and 25, this day will I put the dread of you and the fear of you upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall hear report of you and shall tremble and shall be in anguish because of you. Okay, if God had not done this, what would have happened if he had settled for the family of Abraham? Who's going to dread the family of Abraham? I mean, yeah, there's 70 men. But who's going to dread 70 men? Nobody. But if God had a nation, if he had millions of people, if he had hundreds of thousands of fighting men, and they were all doing good and all blessed and all prosperous, that would be impressive. And that's why God did it this way. I will put the dread and fear of you into the nations that's practicing idolatry all around you. He planned to send another message. This time, this one is to Israel, not the other nations. This message was to Israel, Deuteronomy 4 and 38, to drive out nations from before you, greater and mightier than you are, to bring you in, to give you their land for an inheritance, as it is this day. You couldn't do this without me. God wanted them to know this. It was the message against sin, Deuteronomy 9 and 5. Not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart do you go to possess their land. Now, you know, this is getting sort of hard to rationalize. If they weren't good, then why did God pick them? You almost get to the point of trying to figure out how much predestination is going on here. But it's not just here. It's last night. If you think of all the things that happened in Brad's lesson, why were they in Egypt in the first place? Because Joseph was the favored son. Why was Joseph the favored son? Because he was the first son born of Rachel, the 11th one. Well, where did the other ones come from? Through the trickery of Laban when he went over to the other land to flee from his brother. Well, why was he fleeing his brother? Because God had picked him over his brother, who was the oldest one. I mean, you just go back step, 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 and step backwards, and you see there was a plan in this thing. Now, what was it? Did God just know that Abraham was going to be the faithful one? Did he just know that Isaac was going to be the faithful one? Did he just know? Did he plan it? Did he make it happen? I can't answer some of these things. I don't intend to. Because if I answered those questions, I'd have to get around to why do you do what you do? Is God planning and making you do the things you do? So then do I say, well, is God in control or am I in control? And if I say God's in control, then I just kind of sit back and just say, well, you know, whatever you want to do. If you want me to be in sin, I'll be in sin. Some people believe that. God's in so much control, you can't do anything. You just give up. And I don't think we want to try to defend that argument. So for whatever reason, God chose these people to send them and put them into this land, even though he knew they were going to mess up, and he knew at times they were going to be as bad as the nations he was destroying. But he felt like there was enough good there that he would stay with them. And that's what gives us hope. Moses sang about the message's effect on the nations around Israel, Exodus 15, 13 through 16. You in your mercy have led forth the people which you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength unto your holy habitation. The people shall hear, be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. Oh, no. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. That's why God had to bring them out of Egypt with such a mighty hand. The message was to affect Israel too. Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 22. This one hits me hard. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what mean the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you. Then you shall say unto your son, we were Pharaoh's bondsmen in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and sore, upon Egypt, upon Pharaoh, and upon all his household. The last three words given, before our eyes. That was part of the plan. The Israelites had to see what God did and what a mockery he made of the Egyptian gods with the plagues. The message was not only of might, but of provision. Deuteronomy 29:5, I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxing old upon you, and your shoe is not waxing old upon your foot. So not only did I protect you and feed you, but I suspended the laws of everything wearing out. The message had a long-lasting effect. 1 Samuel 4:8. This was said by the Philistines when they were going into battle. This is a few hundred years after this whole event. But look at what the Philistines said when they were about to fight Israel. Woe unto us! Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. What a message God wanted to send. And it worked, except in this particular battle, the children of Israel were so sinful that they got defeated. But still, before the battle, the Philistines were shaking in their shoes because of something God had done centuries before. God wanted Israel to believe in God's power. Deuteronomy 4:7, for what nation is there so great who has God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? Take home message here. What about you? Can you say this verse? Can you say this verse? If God is for me, who can be against me? Can you say, who can be against me, because my God is so powerful and so awesome that he'll do all the things that I call upon him for? For Israel to believe through experience, remember, why did 602,000 men after a period of 40 years agree and have the backbone to do something that 604,000 of their ancestors, their fathers, couldn't do 40 years before? They were toughened through experience. And don't you ever think that you and I are going to be anything if we don't learn from our problems. If all we do is complain about our problems and never embrace our problems, we may spend a long time wandering in the wilderness. We may spend the rest of our life wandering in the wilderness, never reaching the promised land. Deuteronomy 8:3-4. He humbled you and suffered you to hunger and fed you with manna which you knew not, neither did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord does man live. Your raiment waxed not old upon you, neither did your foot swell these 40 years. But here's the key word, suffered. He knew you were hungry, but you needed to be hungry. Listen, don't we all have trouble? Doesn't every one of us have trouble of some kind? So what are you going to do? Complain because you got trouble? Who else's trouble do you want? You want to take my trouble? You wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want yours. We've all got trouble. We've all got trials. But with the Lord's help, we'd be made stronger from it. But if we listen to Satan, he'll tell us to gripe and complain and blame God. And here we start wondering. We wander. But why? Why did God do it this way? He could have just made himself a people. Matthew 3:9, Jesus said, think not to say within yourselves, we have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. He could have created him a people. But that wasn't what he wanted. It was a molding process, 1 Samuel 12:22. The Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you, and I can't emphasize this enough, it pleased the Lord to make you his people. Are you letting God make you His people as we speak? It pleased whatever happened to Israel. If you read these stories and absorb these stories, you'll see a parallel in your life. It'll be scary how close what happened to the nation of Israel. And we're just getting started. This is just the birth. This is just the birth. Tomorrow night, Brad is going to talk about the judges. Now, last night, they talked about the conception of God's people, Brad did. The time when the Lord dealt with people more or less through the head of the family, which was the male member, which was called a patriarch. It was the family dealings, the family relationship, a patriarchal dealing. Tonight, we talked about the birth of God's people where they had a ruler, a leader. It was Moses. He led the people on this journey, this 40 years. Now, things are going to change again because where I'm stopping tonight is when they have come into the promised land. They divided it. The tribes are trying to learn how to make a civil life. They're going to have a different kind of leader than what they've had before. And that's what Brad, Lord willing, is going to talk about, that period of Israel's growth, that kind of leadership tomorrow night. So here's the lesson. I hope it was interesting to you. I could only give you a snapshot of part of this story, but it's so beautiful and it's so wonderful. I just hope that I could present it in a way to move you as it deserves, as the story deserves. So if we can be of any assistance in obeying the gospel or through the prayers of the church for strengthening or restoration, if we can help in any way, please let us while we stand and sing.
When we walk with the Lord.